Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to talk now about Islamophobia, where it comes from and how to respond to it, in particular if you're a Muslim. In the past year, with terrorist attacks from Paris to San Bernardino, some members of the Muslim community, including here in Boston, say they're encountering new levels of anti-Muslim sentiment. Last month, Boston composer Mehmet Ali Sanlakal, who is Muslim, told my colleague Meghna Chakrabarty about his discomfort with anti-Muslim rhetoric here in Boston following the terrorist attacks in the U.S. and Europe.
Had you had that feeling before here?
No.
Never,
no.
Not
never,
once.
Never, not even during 9/11, nothing, no. Because I think this kind of rhetoric has never been professed in a way that it is out there right now.
Now, one Duxbury-based Muslim married couple, Sebastian Robbins and Mona Haydar, felt that same kind of discomfort. They didn't even want to leave the house. It had gotten so bad. But then they had an idea. Set up a table, put up a sign that read, "Ask a Muslim," hand out free coffee and donuts, and just talk to people. They've been doing it since December, and they're here with us in the studio right now to talk about their experience, why they're doing it, and what they've learned. And Mona and Sebastian, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's great
Thanks.
To be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you. And we want to invite our listeners into this conversation. Listeners, we want to do a radio version of the Ask a Muslim table. What do you want to ask? What don't you understand about Islam? Or if you're a Muslim, what do you think the broader community needs to understand? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook. You can tweet us at Radio Boston as well. Now, I'd love to ask you, I'll start with you, Sebastian, but I want to encourage you both to chime in.
We're married. That's
how we
do.
You're married. That's what you do. So we're very informal here. Tell me where this idea came from. I'll start with you, Sebastian.
Yeah, it was, as you said, in the wake of the San Bernardino attacks, which came on the heels of the attacks in Paris. And we not only felt the effects of those attacks, but the inevitable backlash that came almost instantly from politicians, from the media, from people, from the anti-Muslim violence. And it just put us into a deep, almost state of paralysis. Mm-hmm. and depression, and this feeling that something had to be done. And we didn't know what that was. And we were in a place initially of waiting for someone else, for something else to happen. After a couple of weeks of this, after just this fear that I really felt for the first time in my life, as you said, afraid to leave the house, afraid to be in public, afraid for my wife to be out in hijab, this sense that of almost desperation that we had to do something, anything. And so this idea came to us, and it was... you know, I don't think we took it that seriously ourselves in the beginning. It was sort of this whimsical idea to just give out donuts and coffee and talk to people. And
with a sign that said, "Ask a Muslim." Mona, I'd love to get your experience. This fear, this idea that it was actually not comfortable for you to leave the house. What made you feel that way? What had you experienced?
I mean, I've definitely experienced discrimination from people who just automatically assume that I represent some kind of ideology that I certainly don't, especially when it represents violence or anything like that. I'm, you know, staunchly anti-violence in any form. And so when people project that onto me, it hurts. And from a psychological perspective, it's difficult to manage, because one thing I think people really don't understand is that when a Muslim perpetrates a crime, especially a terrorist type of crime, Muslims are the first to experience that real, like, pain and suffering as a result of that. Because here's this person who is perpetrating an act supposedly on my behalf that I totally, totally, totally don't stand for. And how could that be real and true? And then that being projected onto me as a result of that.
I can imagine how painful that is. Sebastian, you converted to Islam about 3 years ago, and I'm just curious how your experience, or how you experienced Islamophobia differently post-conversion than previously.
Yeah. You know, I thought I understood what white privilege was. I considered myself this educated, liberal guy. But as a white, straight, college-educated, upper-middle-class guy. I really didn't know what it meant to have privilege until I suddenly joined this beautiful faith and this amazing community that was suddenly being vilified. And I realized what life is like for the majority of people who don't fit that that mold, that sort of white standard. And Islamophobia was always something that obviously I, you know, stood against and tried to combat, but it became personal, you know, for the first time in my life. And
so you experienced a really sort of dramatic episodes of in which you were targeted by Islamophobia.
No, I would.
But isn't it funny? You know, when we would be standing out there, and especially when Sebastian would be standing out there by himself. I think, babe, you could talk about that.
Well, people would be like, okay, I'd be out there and they'd be like, oh, where's the Muslim? And I'd have to raise my hand, like, right here, you know, because I don't fit that. And because I think Islamophobia is sort of a code word for racism, right? Yeah. It's sort of a lightly coded way of being bigoted and being anti-Arab, anti-Asian, anti-African, because that's...
And anti-dealing with your fears of the other, of the unknown.
Yeah. So I didn't experience, because I'm undercover. I don't look Muslim. I don't dress Muslim, quote unquote. So it was not a direct personal thing, but it was suddenly seeing the world through my wife's eyes, suddenly seeing how she was perceived, seeing how the same person in the store would treat her differently, or treat me differently once she walked in and stood next to me.
Yeah.
And then feeling the pain that, as Mona said, these millions and millions and billions of Muslims are feeling in a different way, because I feel connected to that community, because those are my brothers and sisters.
Well, I'd love to hear what happened at this Ask a Muslim table that you've set up. First of all, Mona, what did you expect to hear? I mean, did you imagine that you were going to be engaged in sort of passionate debates, or what did you expect? How did you expect this to play out?
Yeah, so as a theologian to be, I had these fantasies that it would be heated discussion and really like intense questions from people who would put me on the defense. And I realized really quickly that I couldn't go in with that notion, that I had to go in really believing that people would come with their curiosity and that I would be able to, you know, meet them with my own curiosity and with my own, you know, intention of connecting with another human being rather than trying to explain away pain, because that's, you know, that's really what people want, is to say, I have this pain deep down inside of me that I feel like comes from the Muslim aggression or Muslim whatever, and I need you to explain that away from me, for me. And so really what I tried to do is to say, well, let people come at me with whatever they have, you know, whether it's pain, whether it's hurt, whether it's joy, whatever, you know, and let that be what it is. And let's talk about it. Let's engage. Let's discuss. Let's connect.
And what did they come with, Sebastian? I mean, was it a mix of things? Was it pain? Was it joy? Was it difficult questions? How would you summarize what you received out there?
I would say the majority of people who talk to us and who engage with us really wanted to thank us for what we were doing, wanted to connect. And what I realized, I think what we both realized, is that sort of pain I was talking about initially, the depression, the paralysis post-San Bernardino, you know, was felt very, very strongly by Muslims, but it was also felt by many, many, many other people. And there was this sense of wanting to commiserate, and people who were not Muslim wanting to say, I'm really sorry for what happened. And I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do either. And I just, I want to thank you guys for doing this. And people who just wanted to like, hey, this is so cool. What are you guys? Who are you guys? This is neat, you know? And then they would say, I don't really know what to ask you. And so we'd have to tell them, well, ask us about the Red Sox. Ask us about raising a kid. Ask us what it's like to be alive. And then many, many people who were...
Because we're not a one-trick pony,
right?
We're in the fullness of what it is to be a human. We are that.
The best suggestion we got from someone said, your sign shouldn't say, ask a Muslim. It should say, ask a human being who happens to be Muslim. And that really encapsulated what we were doing. We did get questions about Islam and about our faith and about our marriage.
And I got a lot of questions about wearing hijab and you know, covering my body in the way I do and the way I choose to dress, you know, and that was really powerful for me, to especially when a woman would come up and she was Orthodox Jewish, she was an Orthodox Jew, and she would say to me, you know, I wear my tichel and you wear your scarf, and I actually feel like that that is something huge that we haven't really talked about in, you know, the interfaith communities. And really, I feel connected to you.
Sure.
And, you know, so we had really beautiful encounters, really amazing and brilliant people came up to us and had really amazing and brilliant questions. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time they had nothing to do with Islam.
Sure. I am curious, though, Mona, how you responded to folks when people did come up and say, why do you wear a hijab?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a really deep question for me. You know, I was 11 or 12 years old riding my bike through my neighborhood and feeling, you know, the wind rush through my hair. And I just felt motivated and moved to start wearing hijab in that moment, you know, as an 11-year-old. And, you know, for me, it represents so much. It represents standing up to the beauty industrial complex. It's a spiritual practice that I take on every single day to say that I'm not just this body, that I'm so much more. I'm an intellect. I'm a mind. I'm a heart. I'm a soul. I'm so much more than just this physical form that represents me in this moment. And you know, beyond that, hijab is also an act of freedom of expression, that I choose to be seen in the way that I choose to be seen as a woman, as a feminist, in the fullness of my being. I get to represent myself the way I want to. And for me, hijab represents that.
Listeners, we're talking to Mona Haidar and Sebastian Robbins. They're a married couple. They're both Muslim. They set up an Ask a Muslim table near the Cambridge Region Latin School in Cambridge, as well as other places, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about that in a minute. But join the conversation if you have questions, 1-800-423-8255. So, Sebastian, let me ask you about that table at the Cambridge Region Latin School. First of all, why did you pick Cambridge?
I grew up in Cambridge,
yeah.
And I haven't lived in Massachusetts for a long time until recently, so it's kind of a homecoming. You know, I had actually never been there. This is how naive we were. I didn't know that Cambridge Region Latin was the school where the two brothers who committed the Boston Marathon bomber
attack. The Tsarnaev brothers, yeah. Right. And this came up, right, in the question.
It did. It really caught us by surprise, and it was quite a shock. And we actually had an amazing conversation with teachers and made a great connection with the MSA there and also someone who had been close friends with one of the brothers. But, you know, it was really just for arbitrary reasons. It was beautiful. We were so afraid the first time. We didn't want to just be on a street. And so doing it in front of the library gave the illusion that the library was kind of sanctioning and supporting our event. So it kind of gave us a little bit of safety. We also have a 2-year-old, so we needed a place to go in and use the bathroom. So the library gave us that, and it was warm. And, you know, it just sort of for funny reasons.
And it was a
reasons.
Beautiful setting to do, yeah. It. You know, what a more beautiful place than a public library where people are coming to learn,
yeah,
new things.
Yeah. Yeah, ended up being
I can imagine that among the questions you heard from maybe a thoughtful person would be, look, you know, obviously we're not going to make an assumption that all Muslims are terrorists. But these days there's so much of these horrible acts that come from fanatical Muslims in the terrorist world.
Right.
So why aren't more Muslims speaking out against it? Is that a question that came up?
Absolutely. That was probably our number one kind of Muslim-oriented or Islam-oriented question. You know, why aren't more Muslims speaking out? Mona has some thoughts about that. I want to let her.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of ludicrous to say why aren't more Muslims speaking out, because we are. Every Muslim organization and institution has spoken out time and time again, and we're kind of tired. It's 99.994% of Muslims who are normal and live boring and mundane lives. It's the 0.006% who like have co-opted this word Muslim and these, you know, the title of Islam. Like, ISIS does not represent Muslims. And so to say that Muslims have to stand up against ISIS and to say that time and time again, it's kind of just a headache. And it's like, oh my goodness, it's like telling, I can't even think of a good enough example for that, but it's ridiculous to say that I have to go out and march in the streets against somebody who does not even represent me.
Not only who doesn't represent, but who all of these 1.5 billion Muslims do not recognize as Muslim. I mean, I think that's
right.
The key point to recognize. They are deciding to call themselves Muslim, but the 99.99 that Mona's referring to don't even recognize them as Muslim. Not Muslims that have gone astray, not Muslims who have gotten the wrong idea or who somehow interpreted the Quran wrong. No, they're not Muslims, just like the KKK are not Christian, despite any, you know, attempts.
Let's go to some callers. We've got a lot of folks who want to get in on this conversation. So let's go to Kay, who's calling from Marlboro. Kay, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony, and absolutely, I do not have any relation with KKK by any way.
Okay, I didn't assume you did, but go ahead, Kay.
I have any resemblance with that. I'm sorry.
What's your question, Kay?
Okay, my question is to Sebastian. I heard earlier him speaking that he is a liberal mindset. He has a liberal mindset. He always has been like that. So I was curious, why did he choose to change his faith or accept Islam 3 years ago? I was just curious about that, and I can take the answer offline.
Kay, thank you so much for the question. Sebastian.
That would take me a long time to answer, but...
In 29 seconds.
Let me just say, I was inspired mostly by beautiful people that I've met, including my wife. I think you can read beautiful things. The Quran is an amazing text and a raising entree, but really it was through meeting Muslims who I just felt were leading very inspiring, beautiful, humane, and connected lives, and that brought me closer, and... I'm on the path every day to learn more.
Kay, thanks so much for that question. Let's go to Beverly, who's calling from Watertown. Hi, Beverly. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi. How are you? First, I just want to say, I hope correctly, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. Hmm.
And I learned that in the 60s, so you know, because I'm old. I just wanted to say I'm African-American. I wanted to say this for some time, and in fact have said it. I have never seen anything that so closely resembles or equates to the racism that I have experienced all my life as the anti-Muslim Islamophobia that I have observed and heard about. And I know it is heinous. It's heinous. There are many good people I know, fortunately, of all colors and kinds who oppose it.
Well, Beverly, thank you so much for putting that idea on the table. What do you think, Mona?
I'd love to share. Thank you for that, first of all, and for that recognition of what Muslims are going through, especially in this country right now. But I just want to share that there are estimates that say one-third of American Muslims are African-American. And to say Black Lives Matter is the same as, you know, anti-Islamophobia work is to say that Black Lives Matter, right? Mm-hmm. So they are one and the same because largely Muslims in this country are indigenous to this place and are not foreign, are not immigrants. And that's a huge percentage, one third. I mean, that's just huge. And so just to hear somebody say that and to be seen in that way is really remarkable and beautiful. And really, thank you for that.
Beverly, thank you for that call. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Imam Yasser Fahmy is senior imam at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center. And welcome to you, Imam. It's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been listening to this conversation. I'd love to just get your quick response to this idea of Sebastian and Mona's Ask a Muslim table. What do you think?
I just want to have them continue talking. I've been really enjoying listening in. I'll be honest, I just really want to begin by commending them for overcoming the fear and being willing to be vulnerable. I think that's a very beautiful thing. And I think it's very prophetic. You know, when I look and study the lives of the prophets, I see people who are willing to be vulnerable, willing to put themselves out there, and willing to connect with people on a human level. I think the genius of what they've done and these types of initiative, what they do, is they teach us to humanize one another. I mean, one of the biggest problems we have as Americans is that we tend to live in silos. We tend to live very closed off lives. And when we're kind of operating based on what we hear in the public discourse and not really connecting to a human being, it's very hard to humanize that person. I've read that the biggest remedy to Islamophobia really is meeting a Muslim, right? That's been one of the greatest remedies to dealing with Islamophobia, just meet a Muslim. I mean, Sebastian said earlier, meeting his wife was great for him in that he learned what a beautiful human being looks like. And similarly, I think that, you know, the average American, when connecting with a fellow human being on a base human level, it removes all the ambiguities, all the fears, and allows you to see, wow, this is just a normal person.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you've just put your finger on something that I really wanted to ask you about, because it seems to me what Sebastian and Mona have done is to sort of demystify, you know, what it is to be a Muslim, instead of this sort of theoretical, perhaps scary or foreign idea. It's like, oh, they're normal people. They've got a kid. They've got to take their baby to the bathroom. I mean, in many senses, it seems like this is a goal of yours at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the fundamental spheres that we try to kind of operate through here at the center is the sphere of service and the sphere of being neighborly. What they've done by setting up a table is really living a prophetic ethic of neighborliness, just knowing how to connect with those around you on an intimate human level. We have multiple programs here where we try to constantly invite people, listen, come in, meet Muslims, sit down and talk. You know, 60% of Americans have not actually met a Muslim face-to-face and sat down and have a conversation. I mean, that's huge. Mm. It's huge that the average American, you know, overwhelmingly has not sat down, had a good conversation with a Muslim, although 100% of Americans have heard something about Islam, and 10 out of 10 times has probably been bad.
Well, is there something that the ISBCC is doing to help remedy that? In other words, if folks are curious about what it means to be a Muslim or to come to your organization to understand it better, what can they do?
Well, we have multiple programs. Just a number of them is we have a tours program here at the mosque where people can sign up for tours, whether you're by yourself or you're a school or your organization or corporation, whatever you would like. You come in, sign up for a tour, and you'll have a full scope tour of the center as well as a brief on what Islam is and what Muslims are about. We also have launched a Neighbors for Neighbors program. And that is in the spirit of really connecting to our neighbors on an intimate level here in Roxbury, connecting with people, going out, speaking, advocating, learning about people's lives, and what kind of service we could be. And then mutually, we want people to come in. We want people to come in and say, hey, listen, you know, what are you guys about? And you know, I want to learn. And we have multiple programs that are for that as well. We have classes on Mondays and Wednesday nights about Islam 101 and living Islam.
All right, so lots
of... You can get that basic insight.
Lots of opportunities there. Imam Yasir Fahmy, he's the senior imam at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center. Imam, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful to have you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So, Sebastian and Mona, I'd like to sort of... We have just less than a couple of minutes left with you, but... tell me sort of what's next. Are you continuing with these Ask a Muslim tables? Are you going to be doing more?
Yeah, we hope to. We have yet to publicize, you know, where and when we've been doing it just because, again, the fear, even though I think things have quieted down in the last few months, it's still out there. We've been really honored to speak at a number of churches around Boston and actually nationwide. We were just down in Florida.
But better that they pop up spontaneously. But it's too bad that you have to be worried about the idea of publicizing it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. I think if I were a single guy without a wife and a son, it would be a little different.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we are playing around with is a book idea of the most commonly asked Ask a Muslim questions. And it's really interesting. So, you know, feel free to tweet at me, to anybody who's listening, or to send me a message on Instagram or Facebook to connect with me. And I would love to hear your questions because we are trying to compile them and to, you know, work them out with people and to say, hey, like, this is your opportunity. Ask me, especially when it comes from a place of real curiosity. Mm-hmm. We love that, and we're open to that every single time.
All right. Well, that's Mona Haidar with her husband, Sebastian Robbins. They are the sponsors of the Ask a Muslim table, which might be coming to a community near you. Sebastian, Mona, thank you so much for joining us. We're really grateful. We're really grateful that you came in.
It's an
Thanks
honor.
So much.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield, joins us for our weekly check-in on the world of sports. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.